97.5, 1280 The Zone and The Zone Sports Network. Hans Olsen, Scott Girard live here at Tim Daly Nissan in Murray, 4500 South State Street. Got a bunch of Jazz gear available for you right now, so come by and let's get you squared away and get you taken care of. Let's go. Joining us now, David Locke, play-by-play voice of the Utah Jazz, joining us. David, how are you?
Hey, David.
I like Jazz gear. What can I have?
Whatever you would like, David.
Really?
We got a bunch of these shirts from the playoff run, so you can go with a black Take Note, or there's an orange.
Oh, I have the black. I was wearing the black Take Note with the yellow writing yesterday.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. We've got some of those. Do you have the orange ones?
I do not.
A little bit of a smaller Take Note on that one, but that's available for you.
We just ran out of the Dante Exum bobbleheads. We had some of those.
Those are Rodney Hoods.
Oh, were they Rodney,
Rodney Hoods? Yeah,
they were Rodney Hood. Those were good.
It wasn't a Trey Burke.
No, we did not have any of the Trey Burks.
Okay.
And we got some hats, too. So I don't know what your hat total is looking like, but we can get that squared away for you as well.
I'm wearing a Jazz visor as we speak.
Hey, I'm getting to a certain age where, like, I got LASIK about 10 years ago, and they told me, like, hey, this is going to be a great opportunity, but you might need reading glasses, you know, coming up here in a bit. And I saw you rocking the spectacles the other day. Are you?
It's over.
Yeah.
It's over. Once you know, it's brutal because once you head down that line to start using them, then, like, now I can't do anything without them. But when I was fighting it, I was like, what am I fighting? Like, I'm not going to make it to, like, 60 without using these things. Like, but once you start using them, your eyes just fall apart. Like, it's brutal.
Are you, have you had to increase the font on your cell phone yet?
I accidentally did it the other day on my texts. I don't know how I did it. I think it's wonderful.
Are you not?
I haven't. Let's just say this. I have no idea how I did it. I have not searched to see how they fix it.
Are you not a LASIK candidate?
I have 2015 long vision.
Yeah, LASIK.
Oh,
yeah.
It's only for long.
Yeah. That's
right. Like, I've always had just amazing, like, long vision. I just, like, and every now and then I happen, like, during play-by-play, every now and then I'll see something and Ron will look at me like, how do you see that? But the short, you know, the one that's hard now is play-by-play is going from the computer screen to the floor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
I could see that.
Like, I had my glasses pretty much on my hooked them, you know, like a really snazzy look, hooked on my shirt all year long. I have not gone to the thing around your neck where your glasses hang yet, and not ready for that. Somehow, to me, that adds 10 years to your age.
Yeah, that's not a good look. You probably want to avoid that. I was doing a little woodworking on the lathe the other day, and I was trying to sand off this little spot, and I couldn't see it. I'm like, what is going on? And then finally pulled back a little bit, and I'm like, oh, there it is.
How old are you?
44.
Yeah, it shouldn't happen yet. You need two more years till it happens. That's like, okay. They literally say, like, it's going to happen at 47. Mine happened 46, 47. Mine happened badly this year. 50 was kind of the breakthrough where I quit. Like, I stopped fighting it. Like, it's now a problem if I go to dinner without my reading glasses and get the bill.
Oof.
I know there like are
the
a
other,
lot of...
The other night I thought the waitress, we went out for dinner, the bill should have been like $73. I thought the dollar sign was a two. I thought she had charged us $273 and was like, there's a mistake here. It's like, why?
All right. Let's talk. Where's your concern level for Team USA, and is it something that's even a storyline for you?
You know, my real concern level, and maybe this is totally unfair, my concern level is Pop.
We brought that up earlier in the week. I'm glad you're going there.
That's my concern level. Is I didn't think he was very good in the regular season this year in the NBA. Like, we're just being totally honest, and maybe his team's not very good. We'll see over time. But like when we played him, like. It was like, whoa, what's going on? Like, and then if I remember correctly, he coached a team recently in international play that looked questionably motivated. And then I didn't love his answer yesterday about like, well, Jerry Sloan ran the same play for 20 straight years every single time down, and that's what we're going to do. We're just going to be very simple on offense and very simple on defense. It's like, I mean, I get it. You don't have a lot of prep time, and so you can't be too complicated, but you got the best players in the world, so you can be a little complicated. So I'm a little concerned on just that the world's caught up to our structure, and, you know, maybe that's unfair on Pop, like, but I do think the international game's different, and I know he's immersed himself and spent a lot of time in it, but it's like it's an entire NBA, like, I almost feel like they need to have an international coaching staff whose job is for the year to coach that team, and then the head, and they report to the head coach. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, like, Pop could be the head coach, but there's three coaches in the league, three coaches who are following and scouting and preparing international game plans that are different than NBA game plans.
Well, so, you know, David, I was thinking about this.
It's kind of ridiculous. It's kind of ridiculous to talk about Pop, right? He's going to the Hall of Fame, but, I mean, we've also seen the greatest coaches in every single sport. At some point in time, the game does slide by them a little bit. And so I don't know if that's happening to Pop or not, but there definitely was that murmur throughout the NBA season this year.
Well, I don't know if the guys are dismissing what he's saying, but there's just a lot of hero ball, and it feels like the international game and the way they officiate the international game goes directly against your ability to run hero ball, just with your ability to defend so aggressively.
If you're not running, if you're doing what he said, which is you're not running a lot of plays, and you're just being very simple and running the same thing over and over again, I think you're more likely to fall into hero ball.
Yeah.
Now, on the other end, maybe the heroes don't have a lot of interest in learning a really intricate offense in 10 days. But these guys are basketball geniuses, so they can do it if you can get them to do it. Right? Like Kevin Durant and Dame Lillard are not going to have a hard time picking up new actions, new angles, new stuff in a 10-day period of time. They're the greatest in the world.
Right.
And then the other...
So I'm concerned. I think the second game against Australia is telling. Though, frankly, if I was Australia, I wouldn't play my guys, because I have the psychological edge now, and I wouldn't play Patty Mills and Joe Ingles and any of those guys in this next exhibition game. I just totally sit them all. Because the worst thing that could happen to you, sorry, my apologies, the worst thing that could happen is that you play your guys, USA comes out and blasts them by 30 and completely negates their win.
That's pretty funny. That's actually, yeah, I see what you're thinking. Yeah.
We're going to rest, guys against Team USA.
Right. If I was Australia, I'm playing Dante 35 minutes to see what he can do, and I'm finding out some of my young guys while Ingles, Dellavedova, and all my other guys are just sitting. Patty Mills.
I had no idea Matisse Thybulle was on that team until I saw him suit up for the Boomers, too. That's a guy that can cause a lot of problems on the perimeter as well. From
how did he get
standpoint.
On that team?
I have no idea, but some kind of lineage there somewhere, apparently.
Right.
What's
the rule?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure.
I know my son cannot ski for Japan.
He cannot?
Because his grandparents were born in the U.S.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was trying to think, like, Mike Brown was the head coach in Nigeria, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no rules on coaching.
Okay.
But athlete participation... I think you have to have had your grandparents born, at least have your grandparents born in the country. Maybe every country is different, though. Like, I don't. And Olympics are different than World Championships.
I wonder what the rule is on that.
Yeah.
But some psycho dad has researched this about skiing.
Well, and there's a lot of guys, like, I think Travis Hansen.
That was supposed to be funny, by the way.
I know, that was funny. Travis Hansen at BYU and then Spencer Nilsson, they got the golden ticket where they got some level of residency.
Dual citizenship.
Dual citizenship, yeah. And I don't know if that would count towards.
Did they play Olympic? I don't know that.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't know if that transfers to an Olympics. I know that allows you to play overseas.
Right. Because the overseas, the rules are there's only so many players on every roster that can be foreign. And so if you can be if you get citizenship in a European country, then you don't classify as a foreigner.
And you make lots of money.
It's good. Yeah,
so,
smart.
So David, let me get this straight. So you're
Travis Hansen's a Russian, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Spencer Nilsson is some weird, bizarre, like Azerbaijan or some funky country.
Good for him. Hope he flies the flag.
So you're saying that
sure
your son could participate for Japan
really
if his grandpa – if if your wife's parents were born in Japan, but they were born in America, but if they were born in Japan, he could participate or compete for Japan. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so. Yes. Huh. Actually, most of his great grandparents were born in the U.S. too, which is like, there's a very funny moment in our family. We were in Japan. We were watching the Olympics that were in China. Because we were in Japan, we got ping pong. And it was a German versus a Japanese in a ping pong game. We had the whole family together, and everybody was rooting for the Japanese guy, except for me, who was supposed to be rooting for the German, and because that's where my family's from. But then all of a sudden, in the back, like myself and my wife's brother got together, and we started to try to figure out the lineage of our families, and we found out that like my family actually came to the U.S. like 10 years before theirs. But the stereotypes, probably racist, but the stereotype is that the white guy's been here a lot longer than the Japanese guy, right? Like that's, but that in this case is like almost not true at all. And so the joke was going to be that my kids had to switch and join me on the German side because they had ancestors that were more recently in Germany than in Japan. But it turned out to not be true. The crazy one is like, just on, since it's, you know, July, we'll talk about this. My wife's great-grandparents went back and forth between the U.S., they were born in Seattle, went to Japan, and came back on boats.
Wow. That took a little while.
In, like, 1900s, like early 1910, like one of them went back for an arranged marriage. So, talk, you know, so it's like different generations. So her grandmother went back, was the ultimate catch, right, because it was an American citizen. And so went back for an arranged marriage and then got back on the boat with her new husband and came back. Different world.
Different world. Huh? Yeah, no doubt.
Pretty incredible. I love ancestry. Love stuff like that.
And I think it's interesting, like, just like shifting your mindset, right? Like on that whole concept that I talked about, like, you know, my wife gets asked all the time, like, where are you from? And her answer is Los Angeles. And so, no, where are you from? I'm from Los Angeles. Like, yeah, like, are you asking my ancestry? In. That's a different question.
Jeez. Uh-huh. All right. So the Jazz front office, obviously getting ready for the NBA draft. Is there, I mean, everybody talks about Jimmy Butler, but there's really, and I don't know how much time you spent with the draft, if this is a better draft than usual or what the tiers are looking like this year. But there's some people that I ran into that talked about, well, what can you get at 30? And my answer is not much, because if he's at 30, there's a reason he's at 30. What can the Jazz possibly do, if anything, to help bolster this team throughout the with the draft?
So we do an ultimate mock draft on the Locked On Podcast Network.
Yeah.
That will air starting Monday, and people are welcome to listen to it. And I had the 30th pick. And I was offered the 45th and 46th, I think, from Toronto. And I was offered the 44th, 47th, and 58th from Brooklyn.
Wow, take it.
Would you make either of those deals?
I'd take the Brooklyn one for sure.
So I took the Brooklyn one. Yep. So I traded the 30th pick for 3 second-rounders. And my thought was, if I was really the GM, I would probably select one, maybe two, if I had players I liked. Might sell one, right, just to get money. We're in the tax. And I would probably move one for a future second at some point in time. And maybe I'd move two of them for future seconds. So that was my thought. And as much as anything, because of what you're saying, that the guaranteed contract at 30 is not a positive when you're a luxury tax team for a player that's unlikely to contribute to your roster this next year. Like, if I want to spend the 30th pick is like guaranteed a million something. It's the same as like a veteran minimum. I'd rather probably have Etuan Moore at the minimum than a 30th pick of an NBA draft while I'm trying to win a championship. That was a random Etuan Moore reference, but let's
like
go
it.
With it.
Yeah.
But the concept is, right, a random player that you don't really know that much about, but who, if somebody's hurt, could easily play 15 minutes a night and hold you together. And if in the worst case scenario, I had to play a little more than that, could. Whereas I don't think your 30th pick of the draft is going to be able to do that for you on the caliber of you know, I mean, like Desmond Bane is a nice player. He did a really good job for Memphis. He might have been a super pick by Grizzlies. We may rue the day. But, like, when as that playoff series progressed, he actually didn't get – like, he wasn't – that was too much, right? That was too much for him. They would have been better off if they were trying to win that specific playoff series on that given day to have you know, a player that was a veteran who'd been in the league for 10 years and ready and able to handle it.
All right, David, I know you, myself, Scotty, we can't speak for Ryan Smith. We definitely don't want to spend his money. But what I want to do is I want to say...
What? We're not spending Ryan Smith's money? Do you realize how much fun that would be?
It would be a lot of fun.
Oh, okay, sorry.
But I'm going to put... You're the new Jazz owner. You've got $4 billion. Let's say you got $4 billion in the bank. I want to know what you do with Mike Conley and what you do with the free agent situation and the luxury tax situation right
so
now.
So this is before I, like, get my ski house there and fly between. And this is different than what I'm – that $4 billion is being not allowed to just chase powder ski days?
Yes.
Okay. Like, okay. I don't think Mike Conley's situation is easy and simple. And I do think you have to sit in a room and make a decision as an organization before emotion gets involved of what's too much. Like, I think there's a moment, I think you've got, like, and I don't know the answers, is a third year too much? Is a third year at 15 too much? Probably not. Is a third year at 25 too much? Probably. Right? Like, there's a sliding scale here of years and money and tax impact and winning that's going on here. And I think you have – so the first decision is, does he help you win? And the answer is yes. And the second decision is, he still good? And the answer is yes. And then you have to start making the next decisions, which are that sliding scale I'm talking about. So I don't know the answer, but I don't believe it's just a sign in no matter what. I think there is a point in the process that hurts, and that's fine. And then there's a process there's a point where it's detrimental.
I want to circle back to Pop a little bit. I think Becky Hammon should have gotten the Portland job. But obviously that's their call.
You know, Becky, can I give a counter? I want to give a counter opinion on that.
Sure.
Okay. I don't know that I think Chauncey Billups should have gotten the Portland job. And I think there's something interesting going on right now in the league. There are very, very few head coaches that have been successful that have been assistants only.
So you're saying get the head coaching job, get fired, and then get another job later on, and that's the guy you want.
Stan Van Gundy was a successful head coach. He had been the head coach at the University of Wisconsin, right? Taylor Jenkins was the head coach at a G League team. Eric Spoelstra is an exception to the rule. He came through the system, and he never was a head coach anywhere. Steve Clifford was a good head coach. He was like a head coach at like Augustina State Northern Full Moon University.
So in regards to Quinn Snyder, you're taking the Missouri head coaching job into consideration.
And the Austin Toros head coaching job.
Yes. But was hired as an assistant coach.
Right. But if I'm looking at Alex Jensen, I'm interested in hiring Alex Jensen because he's been a head coach. So I think a little bit of what's going on right now with the Willie Greens and the Wes Unseld Juniors and the Chauncey Billups and some of these hires, and Becky Hammon fits into that. I'm not buying without some head coaching chops.
Is Becky Hammon
really hard?
Is she the next head coach of the Spurs?
Don't know.
I wonder how much say Pop will have in that.
Yeah, I had a theory for a while that Pop would quit halfway through a year and make Becky Hammon the head coach and no one had a choice, but I've been told by people that know that that's a bad theory.
I mean, your sources would be pretty correct, but I think it's going to happen because I think he wanted to be the head coach of the men's of the Olympic team, And I think he could parlay being a head coach of the Spurs into that. And now that he's done it, you can't quit now. But I imagine I've always kind of felt like January, February next year he hangs it up. Not necessarily giving Hammonds the head coaching job, but just that he got he wanted. He's an Olympic coach, and now he's done.
And his wife passed, so there's a huge life transformation he's going through, so I just don't know the answer on that. You know, by the way, one thing we don't really know, like, I mean, I guess he coached the G League team, or the Summer League team. Like, and we don't know this about Willie Green, we don't know this about Wes Unseld Jr., we don't know this about Becky Hammon. Like, this is not, so this is not specific. Like, we actually don't really know who, like, if any of these are good assistant coaches. Right, like their agency builds out a good narrative.
Oh, yeah.
I really would like the chyron at the bottom of all reporters that says who their agency is now. Like, that's my new request for NBA reporting. Adrian Wojnarowski, CAA, right underneath his graphic. Yeah. So when he's talking about a CAA client, you know it?
Yeah.
That would be really helpful for my understanding of narratives. Like, I actually read a piece the other day, which I didn't think was totally fair, but like Rachel Nichols almost single-handedly built the narrative that the Minnesota Timberwolves were incompetent. It was really interesting. Like, I thought it was a little Homer piece, but it was interesting how an individual reporter on the whole Jimmy Butler thing in Minnesota and that practice and all that stuff, like, builds a narrative on a player and then therefore builds it around an organization. Now, Minnesota certainly has not been seamless to their, you know, they've had plenty of things they've done wrong along the way, but it's interesting. I don't know. Sometimes I would just love to see that. Like, you know, I'd like to know because it matters.
Yeah, it does. David Locke right here on the Zone Sports Network. David, always a pleasure, my friend.
Let me summarize my take on this just so it's clear.
Yes.
On the whole concept of when these coaches get hired and they get these jobs and then the narrative is, oh, this is a great hire, we have no idea.
No.
And I just think we should be much more honest about it. Like we just don't have any idea. Like, I mean, you can look at a resume. Like, when Dennis hired Quinn Snyder, that was a pretty unique resume and a super bright guy who'd had success coaching. He'd had a pitfall or two. And there were reasons why you could really look at that and say, like, okay, I'm buying, or you could have just as equally said you're not buying, right? But you actually had a track record. When you're hiring Chauncey Billups and Willie Green and Jamal Mosley or Becky Hammon, like, you don't actually have any idea.
Well,
there's no track record of what they've done because we have not been inside coaches' meetings. We've never seen their scouting reports. We don't really know how they get along that well with players. We really don't know how they get along with players as a head coach because that's totally different than getting along with players as an assistant coach. And we really don't have any track record of what they did in their interviews. So I just think it's really garbage when everyone talks about it. And I think it's really false when everyone talks about what a great hire something is because they just don't know.
Well, I think relationships also have to play a part in that as well. You develop friendships. Like I've had, you know, hundreds of Utah fans stop me in the middle of a grocery store at a gas station and say, hey, what's Craig Smith going to do at Utah? And my first thought is, he's going to be great. But I say that because Craig's a friend of mine, and I root for Craig because I've developed a good relationship. But I know what he did at Utah State, but the Pac-12 and recruiting to that level and coaching at that level, I'm not sure how he's going to do. But deep down, I secretly root for him because he's a friend of mine, and I hope he does well. And so my initial thought is, he'll be great.
But that answer a little, well, there's two things. One, if you're walking through a grocery store and someone asks you, you probably should just answer the question. He's going to be great, right? Like, you're his friend, like, support
yeah.
him.
Yeah,
if you're
for
on
sure.
Air, if you're on air and you're supposed to be giving analysis, I think your analysis right there was perfect. Like, I think he's going to be great. Understand, like, I'm a friend of his, but look at what he did at Utah State. Look what he's done everywhere he's been. He's been successful. Now, this is the next hurdle for him. Can you recruit? Does he understand how to recruit Pac-12 athletes? And can he do it at Utah? And can he do it with the limitations that he has at Utah compared to some of the other Pac-12 schools where he may not have at his other place he may have had the best story to tell in every conference he's been in up to this point other than, you know, maybe one or two places. So but that's just an honest analysis of the situation. I don't think we get enough of that, frankly, on this. But I don't know. I think some of the grandstand, I don't know. I've said my piece.
Yeah, I got you. David, always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Okay, talk to you soon.
David Locke, play-by-play voice of the Utah Jazz right here on 97.5, 1280 The Zone and the Zone Sports Network.